Join Aubrey Masango, evenings on 702.
My guests, Tony Seshel and Khalibuwe Mulisa Pudi are on the line. And let me start off by greeting Bratoni. Bratoni, good evening to you and thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us on this round of Constitutional Speaking.
Good evening, Bro Ops, and your guest. I've been on the radar for some time.
Yeah, we wanted to chase you, man.
Sorry, yeah, my WhatsApp and Facebook accounts were hacked. And I can always get those who do a tins the two-way in the soup.
Yeah.
And this issue I've taken up with Facebook and Meta, whom I believe that they are not doing enough to protect their account holders. And this is a baton that I might just take up sometime later.
Wonderful, wonderful. And perhaps we'll have that conversation as soon as that process starts. But let me also welcome Khalibuwe Mudisa Pudi. Khalibuwe, thank you so much, my brother, for joining us for another round of Constitutionally Speaking.
Good evening, Brawaps, and good evening to Bratoni as well and their listeners.
So I have set out the parameters of the conversation that I'd like to have, but it's by no means limited to that. And I'm asking both you gentlemen, and I'm going to start with you, Mudisa Pudi, by asking the question, why aren't we putting more energy into sports, for example, as a nation-building instrument, or music and arts and culture as a nation-building instrument? It has been said before that those instruments would do well in the nation-building process. And I'm asking the question, is the Constitution, with all of the complexities that we face as a country, all of the issues of interpretation of the Constitution that we face as a country, is it an instrument that could be said to be equal to the task of nation building?
Perhaps the sports and rugby, amongst other sports, for nation building purposes, they are effectively a fleeting moment. So they contribute, but they don't define the project of nation building itself.
Yeah.
And I think you would recall not so long ago, we had political stretch marks in regard to our sports, particularly rugby.
Mm-hmm.
And we had questions about its transformation and all of those things.
Yeah.
And it raises the question. So if we're talking about raising those questions then in relation to those spots, what were they anchored on? And for me, the anchor is in the national aspirations, which for the purpose of these discussions are contained in the preamble of the Constitution. So nation building is a long-term project. It has a number of things that it needs to aspire to. It has a number of institutions that it needs to put into place, and it has certain levers you can use to just drive momentum in a particular direction. And I'm sure we can all recall the usage of the Springboks in the late 90s that the late President Mandela made of in terms of contributing towards nation building. So it's part of an event that helps build the momentum. But it is not itself the project, so to say.
But is the Constitution, therefore, equal to the task? I am a bit facetious in going the route of, you know, equating, maybe even comparing sport and the arts to the Constitution. But I just needed something to use as a background to the conversation that I want to put onto the foreground. And that is to ask the question, is the Constitution then, given its issues? For example, as I said, that the preamble of the Constitution, Mudisa Pudi, is deeply hinged on the Freedom Charter. Some have used the argument that says South Africa is said to belong to all who live in it. And many South Africans look at that particular clause, which is in the preamble of the Constitution, and say, but that is where this Constitution cannot be trusted, because it does not put us as South Africans at the pole position of its priorities. For that reason, can it be trusted as a document that prepares us for nation building, assists us in nation building. And then I'm going to move on to Tony in a few moments' time.
Perhaps I think the notion that the constitution as we have is a detailed exposition of the Freedom Charter is a bit underinformed in the sense that it does not take account of, well, it assumes for one that the other parties went to CODESA and they shut their mouth and the ANC had its way, and hence the Freedom Charter is effectively the constitution. So the Freedom Charter is but one of the source materials that were used to put the constitution together. You also have the Harare Declaration, which was, when it was put together, basically driven by the ANC, but a lot of the liberation movements were involved in its putting it together, as well as what were then called the frontline states, your Mozambique, Zambia, Zimbabwe, etc., as well as the Human Rights Declaration. But over and above this document, what you then had in the process of the negotiations, what each of the parties involved in the negotiations imprinted into it, and that was in the form of what became the principles on which the final constitution are going to be built. If I recall, there were about 24 of them. So it's these principles that then informed whether or not the constitution that we arrive at is the constitution that meets the expectations of all of the parties involved, that meets the aspirations articulated in the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights, on the Freedom Charter, as well as the Harare Declaration. So there's a number of source materials that were used to put the constitution together. And amongst others, it's also looking at the constitutions of countries like Canada. The European Charter on Human Rights also has an imprint on our Bill of Rights as well. So quite a lot of source materials were used to put together the constitution.
So, go ahead.
Go ahead, Robs.
So I was trying to ascertain. So you're saying to me that let us not get into a situation where we look only at the Freedom Charter as a contributing document to the construction of our constitution. Many other documents with various other doctrinal approaches to governance, to ethics, to philosophy have been used in the crafting of our constitution. But does that, according to you, and Dade Modisa Budi, does it give us the sense that the constitution is a document fit for the very huge task of building a nation with our history, with our complexities?
My assertion, perhaps, would be that it is, because the alternatives are too ghastly to contemplate. And I think if we're trying to find answers to the malaise in the body politic in the country, we have to look at the institutions that the constitution frame an existence for, and those would be the political party system, the economic development, economic policies, and all those different levers of nation building. It's not the constitution itself that is at fault. My argument would be that it is actually very much fit for purpose, but it's a number of elements that are not fit for purpose that you should be asking questions about.
Yeah. Well, let's take Bratoni into the conversation. Bratoni, I'm going to start where Ghalebue leaves us with regards to the body politic, and I suppose it's relevant because we are heading towards the 29th of May, where we'll be electing our new leaders and so forth. The Constitution has a lot to say about how that process needs to be handled. In fact, we've got a case in the Electoral Court at the moment around the issue of whether or not a former president, Jacob Zuma, is eligible to participate and be a part of the faces on the ballot to go and participate because he's got some issues with the law, or let me say with his conviction in the past and so forth. I ask you the question. Is the Constitution fit for purpose for nation building, given what it says about the political system of this country? And are the political parties and the political players in this country cognizant of what the Constitution says? I look at some of the promises that are being made by various political parties, and I wonder whether they would, in fact, be able to pass constitutional muster if indeed they were really taken to the cleaners for that purpose. And so the question for you, given our politics, our political system, the fact that we're going to elect our political leaders on the 29th of May, does the Constitution give us the right framework for nation building in that sense and in that context?
Yes, Rob, I just need to say that I concur with my brother that, sports and sports disciplines like rugby are fleeting.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the project to rely on for lasting nation building.
Yeah.
For me, it lies deeper in the heads of the jurists, the dispensers of justice. Now, that is where the flaw is. Your first question, which relates to, is the Constitution a reliable instrument for nation building?
Yeah.
The short and general answer to this question is an emphatic yes. Your second question, I will revert to that and just elaborate on that further. Your second question is, are political parties cognizant of that? Well, I doubt that. In certain instances with the promises that they come up with. Now, with regards to the first question, as I said, the short answer to this question is an emphatic yes. The problem, however, lies in the methodology used to achieve the goal of building a nation. Let me put this differently, Val. It is actually how but what means can one utilize this instrument, which is Queen Constitution, to build the nation? That is the crux of that question. Now, in this equation, we have three separate entities that have to marry and work together to reach that goal. The first entity is Queen Constitution on the one extreme end. The second entity is the nation building, the concept of nation building on the other extreme. And then the third, right in the middle, is the methodology of the tools to marry the two extremes, or the glue to bring the two together to stick and work as a unit.
Right.
Now, and in this, in the last instance, with respect, there lies the problem. Now, the problem is not with the Queen Constitution. It is also not with the concept of nation building. But it is with, as I say, the clue, the glue in the middle, the tools, or the people whom you need to bring the two together. Now, they consist of the entire legal fraternity. Let's leave the politicians out for a moment.
Yep.
Now, in particular, they consist of judges and magistrates who have to dispense justice, as well as legal representatives and academia at universities. Their primary task, is to get to know the nature, the status of Queen Constitution, how Her Highness must be interpreted, and how she must be applied so as to achieve the goals of building this nation, which is possible. It can be done. But if this task is performed in accordance only, if it's performed in accordance of the prescripts of Queen Constitution. Now, for this to happen, Brahms, they need to adopt a new mindset. They need to undergo a paradigm shift. Now, here is where the fundamental problem lies, because, and this is crucial, Brahms, all of them, judges, magistrates, legal representatives, and academics at university, have been trained in the positive tradition, trained in King Legislature's way of thinking and analyzing. I've had a cursory look at some universities' curriculi. There's no significant changes that was made concerning the stuff that the poor students are being fed at the moment. Legal positivity or legal positivism is still ingrained in their minds. They walk around and operate in Queen Constitution's tenure with their head stuck in the old regime of King Legislature. They haven't made that transition from the old to the new. There's no switch, no shift in their paradigm. And I can assure you, Brahms, it requires quite a big shift in one's mind. After having been slavishly trained for six years at varsity, for that period of time, to think in a certain way.
Give me a sense, Bratoni, of what does legal positivism mean?
Legal positivism, Brahms, is the regime of King Legislature. In the olden days, in the pre-constitutional regime or constitutional situation, we had been trained to say that the law is the law and finish and
play. Ah, yes.
So you had to interpret the law strictly according to the legislature's intention. And once you've established, the main issue here is that you need to establish first the intention of the legislature. Once you've established it, you need to apply it according to the letter of the law. You don't take into account any other issues. And that is the issue with regards to
So if I understand you correctly, Bratoni, and I also want to invite our listeners to be part of this conversation. You're saying that the constitutional order that was ushered in 1996 required a mindset, both from our academia and our legal practitioners, that was constitutional and not just legislative in its approach.
Absolutely,
Brad. One that understood that there are contexts, there are certain situations that require interpretation that goes beyond just the letter of the law. And you are saying that as things stand at the moment, these high structures of legal understandings, academia and legislative practitioners, are still themselves stuck in the old ways of thinking, and that is what you call legal positivism and not constitutional thinking. And that is the fundamental issue that is a hindrance to the kind of nation building that would produce a constitutionally conscious nation rather than a country that is a hybrid, a mongrel between that king legislature and queen constitution, if I understand you correctly, Bratoni?
Correct, Brahms. And that's why we have a vast number of confused judges and magistrates out there who are like a million in a large box of smarties. And I'm not surprised if one sees them often bucking up the wrong trees. Fact is, we still have too many King Legislature loyalists who intentionally and even unintentionally actively practice legal positivism. You even find it in the highest court, our constitutional court.
Give me an example, Bratoni, and what you're saying is quite seminal, because it therefore means that what flows out of that, the political system, the politicians, would then of necessity also be stuck in a legal positivism sort of paradigm, even though they might not be legal practitioners themselves, but they themselves won't be constitutionalists in the desired sense of the word for a nation that is to be built by their participation. We, the people ourselves, might still be stuck very much in a legal positivistic type of thinking that misses the mark in trying to be the citizens of a constitutional state, if that makes any sense?
You make perfect sense, Mr. Austin. That is correct. You even find this. Let me give you an example. In the highest court, our constitutional court, there are very seldom unanimous judgments. Dissenting judgments are at the order of the day. One sometimes wonder what some of these judges are smoking. Case in point, the Electoral Amendment Act judgment is all over the place. We have a chief justice who enrolls a contempt of court matter that is expressly prohibited in the Constitution. And it is a blatant violation of Section 1673B of Queen Constitution. Now, that's either through ignorance on his part, the learned Chief Justice, or a gross disregard of Her Highness's authority. You decide which is which. Either way, our Chief Justice is a constitutional delinquent. Or King legislature's private supporter who is undermining Queen Constitution. We have our Chief Justice jailing a person without a trial in his absence, contravening sections 34 and 35 of the Constitution. He denies this person his fair trial rights to legal representation. He denies him the right to be present at the trial, the right to review and appeal, and disregards the entire international human rights law by holding that Section 39(1)(b) of the Constitution and the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR, is foreign law and not applicable. Now, that's wrong. Then you have the seven blind justices of the majority decision, sheepishly following this reason. It doesn't stop there. As I've pointed out earlier, the curricula at university in particular, causes like the interpretation of statutes, amongst others, have not really changed, Robs. And I've been there centuries ago. I've done that. Those causes centuries ago, but nothing has really changed. All or most of the archaic precedents and practices are still being fed to unsuspecting students. Now,
hey, stop you there, Bratoni. I want to invite our listeners to be part of the conversation. I think what Bratoni is saying is that we've got a constitution. And those who must interpret, those who must understand it, those who must give us the parameters of behaviors within those within that constitution are themselves oblivious of its tenets. And so we have a constitution that is wonderful, but that seems not to be customized to the realities of this country. And so I come back to you, Khalebo, and say, if that is the case, is the Constitution then the right instrument for nation building of South Africa? It might be a great piece of documentation, but if indeed there is this disparity between the tenets of the Constitution, the judicial practitioners, I'm talking about the judges, the legal practitioners, the students, I'm not even going to speak about the political parties then. I'm not even going to go there. Then I then must ask the question, is the constitution the right one for South Africa for the purpose of nation building?
But perhaps I'll just two things to raise thematically in terms of my contribution in this round. The first one is that I'll reiterate the point I made at the opening, that the alternative is too ghastly to contemplate when we're talking about nation building. Because to get nation building, I think, as an alternative to constitution making as a as an instrument, then you can have civil war, and the winner dictates what happens. Or you can have a coup d'etat and the military runs the show. And they then define what the national vision going forward is. So for me, that's too ghastly to contemplate. So that's the one point. And I'll just make one point closing on just on that. But the second one is directly, once again, in answering the question, I want to draw two distinctions. The first one is the constitution as a jurisprudential instrument to be interpreted and how it contributes to nation building. I think that's the first one. And my brother, Tony, was essentially talking about two elements of that. One is transformative constitutionalism, as it has been called. So that's one element. And the other element is the stubbornness of, I think he referred to it as a legal positivism.
Yeah.
You'd recall in our discussion when you talk about jurisprudence, I spoke about legal formalism, which is essentially the same thing.
Yeah.
And that lens you can then use to assess whether the judiciary as a leg of the state has been effective in dispensing nation building, given its role in the constitution. So that's the one level of distinction I want to make, the jurisprudential development one. And it is on that, using that lens, that I think we can critique not only the constitution itself, but also the judiciary. But the other leg, which then is where the question sits about the constitution as a nation building instrument, is to talk about the body politic. And I think for that, we are at liberty to single out instances of failure.
Yeah.
So your executive and your legislature, they have a role to play in terms of nation building. And one of the articles I was reading just in preparation for this by Fink Hazom makes reference to corruption. And I think in your interview with Mputumi Ndabeni, you're talking about the demagogy as well.
Yes.
Both corruption and demagogy have effectively diverted the democracy dividend of the constitutional project. So you have instances where, I think we've had a number of cases that we can make references to where social grants were not granted. And the primary reason why they were not granted, because that platform was used as a trough to feed certain interest in the body politic. We have instances where the constitution clearly says that the legislature should hold the executive accountable. But our body politic reality is that decisions were taken outside of parliament that effectively determined what the parliamentarians are going to say in regard of any issue that's in motion for debate or voting. And that, once again, takes away from the democracy dividend. So if you were to look at these three legs of the state, in my view, the executive and the legislature, you have a large body of critique to make about their failure to deliver on the constitutional transformative project. But if you focus on the role of the judiciary itself as well, I think my brother makes a number of valid points about it. Where I differ with him is on the view that to have a divergence of opinion from the apex court on a specific issue is an anomaly. For me, it actually makes sense because the constitution says decisions have to have a rationale. There has to be a reasoning to it. Now, you can critique if the reasoning that's given actually does not make sense, does not tally with the constitutional principles or with the Bill of Rights. But what you have that's different now is that they actually have to give reasons for their judgment. Now, what you don't have in many instances, unless you go to court, is the executive and the legislature in many instances doesn't really have to give reasons for decisions they take, unless you take that decision on review at the higher court. So that's where I want to draw a distinction between the two legs in the discussion.
I want to take some calls from our listeners and hear their contributions, but I do then want to hear your thoughts, both of you, about the political sort of sphere of our country and how, given the constitution and the issues of the disparities between the constitution and legal positivism and the fact that the sharpest minds, legal minds in this country, seem not to be in line with the tenets and the spirit of the constitution, what then of our political space? And given the fact that we are almost at day election, how are they going to deliver promises or efforts of nation building with all of these disparities? I want to go straight to the line and speak to Khotso in Midrand. Good evening to you, Khotso.
Good evening to you, Mr. Aubrey and guest.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead. What is on your mind?
Yeah, number one, on your previous guest, I kindly want to hear him when you talk about the issue of the constitutional. Of the constitution of the South Africa, on the issue of the constitutional project, what I'm saying is that I want him to try to narrate the main function of the constitution as a democratic tool in our democratic project, because South Africa is a developmental state, but out of all the sectors in society, our judiciary is found to be one of the not so reformed, if I can put it.
Yeah.
Number two, on your other guest, I'm requesting him to touch on the issue of the African law. The African law, maybe touching on the issues to do with customary law, because currently we are dealing, or as I'm listening to them, they're dealing with the Roman Dutch law, something which is far-fetched to me sitting here in my village, in my shop, then wanting to subscribe to this so-called...
Where do we find African law?
Exactly.
No, I'm interested to find out from you. So if we're going to apply it as law, where is it written so that we can be able to argue with it or agree with it?
No. To what we heard when we were following the interviews,
yes,
all of them they were conceding that we don't have African law. Instead, African law is part of the.
Or that we don't have it. Law. Oh, I understand. I understand. All right.
Yeah,
I hear you, Khotso.
Let's
hear what other listeners have to say. Lekeng, good evening to you.
Okay. Hope how's it?
Very good. Thanks, Lekeng.
Okay, cool. Yeah, critics to those other people then.
Yeah.
No, you know what, Aubrey? I just want to keep myself focused, you know, because there are quite a lot of things going on
sure.
right now. But I just wanted to talk about the constitution as an instrument of building, of constitution building, you know.
Of nation building,
I think of nation building, sorry. Yeah. I think it's quite ironic that you should use that turn of phrase, you know, because I don't think you realize exactly how literally the constitution is a scale, you know, which is actually an instrument of building.
Yes. Yes. No, now, I am aware of that.
Okay.
Of that. Yeah.
Okay, okay, because I want to take it further.
Mm.
You remember the judge, Hilary Squires, he said that the president had actually lost his moral compass, you know?
Yes.
Now, that was another instrument which he introduced.
Yes.
Into that story. Now, the question then becomes, what is a moral compass then, you know, in the context of this?
Yes.
What is a moral compass? Because everything which is being discussed now, cause I want to go to that legal, for the legal positivism that brother was talking about.
Yes.
In other words, he's saying there must be a moral compass. He's also hinting towards the moral compass. And now, to me, you know, these are problematic things, because I believe in being fundamentalist, you know. We're either going to use a compass for its purposes, and we're going to use a scale for its purposes. In other words, there's no supreme instrument between a compass and a scale. Which is more supreme? What is supreme? Can the Constitution be supreme?
Yeah, I wish you had been part of the conversations when we started this, because it was fundamentally that question to say, where does the Constitution get its legitimacy from to be the supreme law of the country? And I think in a way you're asking that same question, and we've sort of dealt with some of those issues. We introduced issues of natural justice and many other ideas.
Customary law.
And many other ideas. We're going to go into customary law now. But again, Lekeng, I think you are introducing another part of the whole thing to say, okay, so, all right, so I'm going to go back to Bratoni. Bratoni, your thoughts before I hand over to Galeboy.
Braops, with regards to the questions that was raised with in respect of the African law and so on,
yeah.
The Constitution makes provision for it. Section 31 deals with cultural, religious, and linguistic community. So it's not that the Constitution is on one side and the customary practices and laws and so on are excluded. They are in the Bill of Rights, enshrined rights in the Bill of Rights. Section 31 of the Constitution states that persons belonging to a cultural, religious, and a linguistic community may not be denied the right with other members of the community. They must enjoy cultural practices, their religion, use their language, and so forth and so on. So, all those traditional African cultural rights are entrenched and protected in the Bill of Rights in Section 31. With regards to the paradigm shift, perhaps,
yeah.
that should have happened 28 years ago. With respect, I published in 1996 in June, 28 years ago, 6 months before this constitution came into operation. As a young magistrate at that stage, almost 7 years on the bench, I published in the Legal Quarterly Journal entitled The Magistrate, Volume 31, Number 2, June 1996. I published a blueprint for presiding officers, judges and magistrates, about the nature of the Constitution, the status, how this Constitution should be interpreted and how it should be applied. And I quoted verbatim from the international human rights jurisprudence. It unfortunately just flew over everybody's head. And in conclusion, I would say that if we do not get that paradigm shift amongst those who dispense justice, we would be going for the next 20 years, remain in the same confusing situation, and we need to get that out.
Rotoni, I want to thank you once again, and I'm looking forward to the next round that you're going to be involved in. Much appreciated. Tony Setchell, legal expert and former magistrate. Khaleboy, as we say goodbye to you and wait for your joining us in another slot of this conversation, as we invite other experts to give us their thoughts. If the big issue is this disparity between the constitution and the paradigm shift that must take place, not only in the high echelons of academia, the judiciary, and the populace itself, is it not fair to once again ask that question? Is our constitution as it is right now fit for the purpose of building the nation, which is South Africa, with its complexities, its histories, and issues?
Perhaps just two quick points in closing from my end.
Yep.
The first one is to make reference to a study done by the University of Johannesburg on the performance of the South African Constitution as an instrument. And I think reading that just illuminated my mind quite a bit in terms of how to assess whether the Constitution as an instrument and all the institutions that it established, whether it's effective or not. And I think just going there, I think, would enrich the discussions the next time.
Yeah.
I think that's the first point. My last point is, I can't remember where I got this quotation from, but it says that the study of history is the medicine to a sick mind. And I think the relevance of this to the discussion is, one of the things we need to understand for us to have an informed debate about whether or not the Constitution is the right instrument is to understand, where does the Constitution come from? What is the history to its coming into place? What problems was it meant to resolve, so that we are then in a position to then assess, has it solved those problems effectively or ineffectively? Because once you then have that, there's a number of instruments you can then use to assess it quantitatively or qualitatively.
Yeah, I got to tell you that I've thoroughly enjoyed today's conversation. More questions arise about this instrument and its effectiveness for the purpose of building this nation called the Republic of South Africa. But I want to thank you once again for your great contribution, Khaleboy, and as we continue to invite other experts, you will be invited one more time at some point to contribute, and let's continue to edify our listeners and ourselves in this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Perhaps.